From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. This episode, a student reading scores drop, recalibrating fact versus fiction.
Imaginative knowledge is a way of perceiving the world, relating to the world, and changing the world, and nothing can replace it.
The English teacher's dilemma. Then, the gayest city in America is not Provincetown.
Tacoma, in particular, had roller derby teams. Mm-hmm. It had the benefit of Washington State's marriage equality laws, and the state has three LGBT elected officials.
With President Obama's second inauguration this week, we head to the Willard Hotel, just a stone's throw from the White House, and take a trip back in history to Lincoln's inaugural ball. And George Saunders' quirky fiction has been hailed everywhere.
I had a period where I was trying to be a classic writer, you know, with beautiful sentences, perfectly crafted, that explode these beautiful images. I just don't have that gift. I really don't.
More from Quirkyville, Sean Lennon's new music. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Once upon a time, in the long-ago world of high school reading, on a hilltop far, far away, Holden Caulfield was perhaps the epitome of angst, a young man suddenly an outcast in the world he thought he knew. J.D. Salinger's antihero was about to enter a perilous journey of self-discovery. Today, down from the hilltop, high school English teachers may identify with Holden because reading scores for American students have dropped precipitously. How much? David Coleman, president of the College Board, says it's alarming.
We have a crisis in the country around remediation rates. What I mean by that is so many kids, often as many as 50%, graduate high school in this country visibly, demonstrably not ready for the demands of a first-year college course or a career training program, which means they enter remediation courses in college for which they don't get credit, and that's often a path to not completing college, particularly for low-income children.
David Coleman is the lead architect of the Common Core, a sweeping new curricula change which integrates nonfiction into the English program. Only one problem. Where does it leave the catcher in the rye? That's our cover story today. Fiction, nonfiction, and the great debate. The Common Core is an ambitious realignment of school curricula. With remarkable unity, it's been touted by the Obama administration and Republicans and by the two largest teachers' unions. States receive federal money to opt in, and only four states have not. At the heart of the debate, though, is the requirement over exactly how fiction will fare in this brave new world. By the last couple years of high school, 70% of what students will be reading across all subjects must be nonfiction. I asked David Coleman what this achieves.
Fiction remains at the heart of the Common Core standards in English language arts classrooms. For example, Shakespeare is twice required. There's a focus on American literature. What changes instead is that high-quality nonfiction becomes an essential part of the history and social studies curriculum, as well as science and technical subjects. Within English language arts, the only shift is that there's some entry of high-quality literary nonfiction, such as the founding documents and the great conversation they inspired. The idea is that things like Lincoln's second inaugural, Martin Luther King's magnificent letter from Birmingham Jail, these documents are worthy of close attention, not just in a historical context, but also for the interweaving of thought and language. And in that way, they're appropriate for studying English language arts as well.
I don't think anyone would disagree that a letter from Birmingham Jail isn't an important historical document. But I wanted to ask, when those are incorporated into the English class, isn't this something that students should actually be required to read in either history or American studies or social studies?
The idea is that in English language arts, there's a wonderful attention paid not only to the historical impact of such a work, but its use of language, the expression of language through rhetoric. And so what English teachers throughout this country, as well as other teachers, talk to us about is for kids to be ready for the demands of college and career. They should attentively read literature and understand the force of language in that context to convey ideas, to debate them, to distill them. That is also a part of the essential work of preparation and a wonderful part of the force of the English language.
How will you know, as a person who has developed this curricula, if it's working?
I think if the Common Core standards are successful, we should see a world in which remediation rates at colleges, in other words, where kids enter college after receiving a high school degree and still need remediation, we need those rates to go down. So that would be a visible victory. In this country, for the past 40 years, the scores on the National Assessment of Educational Progress in reading in eighth grade have been flat. If we can't have a breakthrough in this country in reading performance, particularly in later grades, so many students will be consigned to a world where they can't read the texts in front of them and hence grow and learn. So success in performance terms would look like breakthroughs in those areas of achievement. Those aren't happen in a moment, but over time.
That's David Coleman, the lead architect behind new guidelines. Before the Common Core, most high school English classes read mostly literature. The reality now is that students must split their time between fiction and nonfiction. There are even some school districts where teachers have been asked to drop novels to meet the new requirements. And that's exactly what Azar Nafisi is afraid of. Nafisi is the author of the critically acclaimed Reading Lolita in Tehran, a nonfiction book. In Iran, she used Western literature to challenge autocratic thinking. Now, she's worried that in America, the great novels will inevitably be sacrificed.
Imaginative knowledge is a way of perceiving the world, relating to the world, and changing the world, and nothing can replace it. So where I disagree with Mr. Coleman is trying to replace fiction with nonfiction rather than finding creative ways of teaching students a very creative interdisciplinary program where you could teach them side by side and focus on quality, rather than on bringing about these sort of changes.
And according to Nafisi, the value of getting lost in a really good novel can't be overstated.
When you look at a documentary or read a real-life story, you can understand the experiences that that person went through. When you read Zora Neale Hurston, you not only understand that particular person's experiences, but you also are able to empathize and become that person. You put yourself in that person's mind and heart. And so the experience is completely different. And that is why I think from time immemorial, human beings have had the need to understand the world through telling the story.
Writer Azar Nafisi, her new book called Dispatches from the Republic of Imagination, talks about the necessity of fiction. However, almost the entire country, 46 states and Washington, D.C., have already signed on to the Common Core. While some states won't adopt the guidelines for several years, others already have. Kentucky was the first. Angela Gunter teaches English at Davis County High School in Owensboro. Gunter says that at first, many of her colleagues opposed the changes.
As you can imagine, we English teachers love our literature, and the greater emphasis on nonfiction text was uncomfortable for some of us.
Now Gunter says her students actually like it. She kept them in the loop the whole way, beginning by showing them their own reading level scores.
When they realized how relatively low they were, it was a really wake-up call for them. They were very upset, and I told them they should feel like they had been cheated. They've not been taught this, and we understood at that point that we needed to start challenging the students more.
Take, say, To Kill a Mockingbird. That's a novel, she says, with deceptively simple language.
However, there are so many themes that are much more complex that require mature thinking that we want to keep it at the high school level. So we paired it with Malcolm Gladwell's piece, which alleges that it's an elitist story, and the kids have never heard that. So the students find that there's a purpose in the reading that may not have been as apparent before.
The downside?
We can't read everything. We can't fit everything in. So we have had to deal with abridging a bit.
Take Shakespeare. Instead of reading all five acts of Julius Caesar, her freshmen now read only the speeches delivered by Brutus and Mark Antony after Caesar's murder, rather than reading the play as a whole. And that's the problem, according to Mark Bauerling. He's an English professor at Emory University. A few years ago, he helped the team developing the Common Core. But he eventually parted ways with David Coleman, mainly because he disagrees with the attempts to standardize learning. Mark Bauerling says the standards pile so much onto English teachers that the cultivation of critical, passionate reading is in jeopardy.
When you interpret these standards at the state level, when you try to develop lesson plans, when you select works to be assigned, when you find the assignments that people have, one can interpret those so broadly that we actually end up with a lot of weak practices.
So what happens to the classic novels, Mark Bauerlein, when we're reducing the amount of fiction students are reading? Is that a concern?
It is a concern. Now, the Common Core has a wonderful standard for 11th and 12th grade English, which runs Demonstrate Knowledge of 18th, 19th, and Early 20th Century Foundational Works of American Literature. But you've got so many other pressures on English teachers in Common Core. The teaching of writing, of nonfiction text, you have research skills that they're supposed to develop. And the problem is that all those classics, they take a lot of time, especially in the hustling, bustling, hyper-digital world of 17-year-olds. I worry that we're just going to find that teachers will teach shorter works, they will spend less time on those classics, and they'll tend to orient them more toward topical, relevant concerns.
Do you think that students and teachers will both in some ways evaluate the entire experience of literature quite differently, so that they're reading with some sort of purpose to fit a curriculum and perhaps, oh, I just want to fall into the world of this novel, maybe getting left out?
The sort of free-floating, open-ended, literary, intellectual experience simply is hard to fit into the achievement orientation and the accountability system. So if the English class does not hold the line against the kid who has a curiosity, who is really struck by Quentin Compson in The Sound and the Fury, the kid who gets taken up with Ivan Karamazov in The Brothers Karamazov, that bright kid who's having issues with atheism or with despair, things that happen often during those years, well, that area in which you want to cultivate the intellect of that thoughtful 18-year-old who often isn't oriented toward grades, but who often ends up being the kind of thoughtful intelligence that ends up doing something extraordinary 10 years later, are we losing the support or at least the conditions that will prompt that student to continue reading and thinking?
That's Mark Bauerlein, an English professor at Emory University and an opponent of the Common Core state standards. You're listening to NPR News. Where would those two cowboys from Brokeback Mountain live if they could choose any place to be together in connubial bliss today? Every year, The Advocate magazine publishes their list of the gayest cities in America. At the top of the list this year, Tacoma, Washington. That struck us as a tad surprising, so we called up a few Tacomans.
Hello?
And we asked them to describe their city in just a few words.
Family-oriented.
Working class.
Rain. Tacoma is rain.
Tacoma has everything you need to have a happy life.
But Tacoma as the gayest city in the country?
I never heard such a thing.
Yeah, wow. They picked Tacoma to be the gay city, huh? Wow.
That's fine with me. I don't care.
Does it surprise me? No. It's not like it's like, what? Yeah, there's all sorts of reasons.
The voices of Tacoma residents, Margaret Jackson, Ellen Cohen, Linda Howell, and Sweet Pea Flaherty. Advocate editor Matthew Breen put together this year's list of America's gayest cities, and he stopped by our studio to tell us how Tacoma ended up at the top of the list.
Tacoma was the right blend of the right size and had the factors that we looked for in the criteria, like whether a city has LGBT elected officials, mm-hmm. whether the city has transgender protections, and things like marriage equality. Of course, Washington with marriage equality this year, we kind of heavily weighted marriage equality states.
You're not, for example, looking at restaurants or places to vacation or nightlife and other things.
We know that a list that said New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco are gay-friendly places would would be rather obvious. Yes, it wouldn't be particularly interesting. I don't know why people would be excited about reading that list. And so we take a sideline look at criteria. We start with a baseline with what constitutes a city. We look at a population of 150,000 or more.
Okay.
Then we add in the sort of serious criteria that I mentioned. And then we take a look at criteria that are a little off the wall. This year we looked at whether a city has a gay rugby team, whether a city has fabulous shopping, cities that had concerts by the Scissor Sisters, Aha Her and Girl in a Coma, and then, of course, cities that had a concert with the Glee cast, which is just such a gay, popular, gay-friendly show.
So I don't think Tacoma has, did it have a concert by Glee cast members?
No. Tacoma in particular had roller derby teams. Mm-hmm. It had the benefit of Washington State's marriage equality laws, and the state has three LGBT elected officials. So we divide all of that by the population, and you get a per capita gayness, which put Tacoma way at the top of the list.
So one of the things you're saying is, look, there isn't a magic city where people who are LGBT might live. They live everywhere because they're your friends and neighbors.
We do indeed live everywhere. We're in all parts of this country. We know that the metropolitan areas have a draw for a lot of LGBT people, but a lot of people stay in their hometowns or move to small towns or prefer a medium-sized city life. You know, there are a lot of LGBT-friendly churches that we looked at in Salem, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are places where people would prefer to raise their families than in a large metropolitan area.
So I just have to ask Matthew Breen, did you call any city officials in or the Chamber of Commerce in Tacoma to announce the advocates' results?
We didn't call them specifically, but we do send out, a press release when the story goes up online. We see instant response. Cities across the country have been really excited about being named on the list. There are a lot of cities and residents who have been very confused by having been on the list. Last year, for example, Salt Lake City was the top of the list. The Salt Lake City mayor tweeted out that they're sorry to have lost their top spot, which I thought was hilarious and delighted to see that people really take an interest in it.
Matthew, this is so much fun. But why do you think this list is important?
We realize the list is tongue-in-cheek to a degree. But the most important thing that comes out of this list each year, people start having a conversation about whether their city is actually LGBT-friendly. If it's not, they want to talk about why that is. The dialogue really opens up immediately. If it is an LGBT-friendly place that people just have not thought was so, they get to maybe look at dimensions to that city that they hadn't considered in the past. The conversation is really what I'm after here, and I'm just finding it happen, all over the place every year. So I'm really excited about that.
Matthew Breen is the editor of The Advocate magazine, which is based in L.A. Every year, The Advocate puts together a list of the gayest cities in America. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you very much.
As we've discussed, the president's inauguration isn't until tomorrow. But here in Washington, a lot of parties are already starting with a glass of something. We're talking about inaugural celebrations, balls, galas, cocktail parties. Emphasis on the cocktail. The Round Robin Bar is just a stone's throw from the White House, and it's a Washington mainstay. At the moment, it's bedecked in red, white, and blue bunting. And Jim Hughes is a veteran bartender there of nearly 30 years standing. He's wearing a matching bow tie. Dapper.
Welcome to the Round Robin Bar at the Willard Intercontinental Hotel, and you are standing here in the oldest bar in continuous operation in Washington, D.C.
A capital fixture since the mid-1800s, the Willard Hotel is synonymous with presidential history. Abraham Lincoln slept in the original Willard the night before his inauguration. President Grant enjoyed drinks in the lobby. Today, the bar is adorned with portraits of past presidents, and Jim Hughes is inspired.
You hear these stories, and that legacy continues. You know, that the history is all around us. I'll say to people, you're walking in the shadow of giants.
In honor of the inauguration, Jim Hughes has come up with a very special drinks menu, distilling that presidential history into 44 cocktails. Our first president, George Washington, favored Madeira, a fortified wine from the Mediterranean. President number 35, John F. Kennedy, would kick back with a beefeater martini served with olives. And as for our current president, his drink, the Blue Hawaiian, is more of an homage to his homeland than something we have even one scintilla of evidence showing he actually enjoys.
This is a beautiful drink. You feel like you're looking at the beautiful blue waters of the Pacific. And, of course, this honors the president's heritage in terms of growing up in Hawaii.
Absolutely. I can almost hear the surf music.
I had heard that the president has a taste for fine-aged tequila. So we've taken a little bit of Patron tequila, with some blue curacao and some fresh lime juice, and then vigorously shake this up. And then I'll actually strain this over crushed ice and, of course, serve it with fresh lime and some pineapple. Mm. It's a wonderful cocktail. Mm. A light libation of extraordinary character.
Tell me about the orange blossom. Who's that for?
Rutherford B. Hayes. And in 1877, he enters the White House. Thing is that he was a teetotaler. He did not drink.
Oh.
In fact, his wife was known as Lemonade Lucy because she was always serving lemonade at functions. So the gentleman who was the head of the Washington Press Corps actually bribed White House staffers to spike the oranges with distilled spirits.
So they'd actually drink gin
they would actually do.
Oranges?
They would actually cut a hole, dig it out a little bit, and pour a little gin in there, and then put the plug back in.
Wow.
And there you go. You got yourself an orange blossom special, which is gin. I'm going to use Plymouth gin, and I'm going to use fresh squeezed orange juice. It's a very simple drink.
Fresh squeezed.
So a little bit of an orange liqueur and a dash of orange bitters. Vigorously shake this, marrying all of the flavors. And there we have it.
I'm going to sample it. Mmm, that is lovely. Thank you very, very much.
Let's try a hot buttered rum. And a hot buttered rum is a cocktail in our collection for John Quincy Adams.
Our sixth president. He becomes president in 1825.
This is a wonderful cocktail, especially at the time of inaugurals, weather tended to be rather inclement. A hot toddy or a hot buttered rum was a very, very popular drink at the time, made with Caribbean rum, fresh spices from the islands, and fresh fruit.
Okay.
I've added my dark-aged
Cruzan rum.
Cruzan rum. Pat of butter.
A generous, beautiful pat of butter.
And what we have is a hot buttered rum.
Wow.
Which
lovely.
President Adams would have enjoyed in the morning.
Oh, this is just delicious, Jim. This drink is like hot apple pie.
And where's the ice cream?
So, do you have a presidential hangover cure?
I've been making this for years. Fresh lemon, fresh ground ginger, or you can use ginger ale and soda water, and then top it off with bitters, either Angostura bitters or my preference is Peychaud bitters, which is the Louisiana bitters. Can't beat it.
Well, Jim Hughes, you have made our visit to the Round Robin Bar at the Willard Hotel here in Washington, D.C. on this inaugural weekend so much fun.
Thank you for joining us here.
Drinking that wine is dead of life. When they get drunk, they want to put them fight. Hooping and hollering and talk all night. When they get drunk, they begin to fight. Drinking wine for the old.
And surely the bubbly was pouring 148 years ago after Abraham Lincoln took his second oath of office. Recently, the Smithsonian did a bit of a document deep dive and came up with the menu for Lincoln's lavish inaugural ball.
There were oyster stews, roast beef, leg of veal, roast turkey.
That's Megan Gambino. Whale, she wrote about the affair for Smithsonian.com.
And lots of dessert, almond sponge cake, macaroon tarts.
The bill of fare, as it's called, provides an exquisite look at how different these presidential balls were just 78 years ago. The food was served buffet style, and as Yale food historian Paul Friedman described it to Megan Gambino, the cuisine could best be described as French via England with some American ingredients.
Oyster stew and pickled oysters. You wouldn't have found those in France as much.
Because people were catching oysters in the Potomac, so it was easy. And terrapin, too, I understand. Turtle stew. Also
exactly.
Popular.
Locavores would be excited about seeing terrapin stew on the menu. Actually, I read in an article from the Washington Post from 1880 that any pretentious affair in Washington had to have Maryland-style terrapin stew.
On March 6, 1865, somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 guests packed into the U.S. Patent Office building. The partygoers arrived around 9. The president and Mrs. Lincoln showed up around 10:30.
President Lincoln was wearing a black suit and white gloves. Mary Todd Lincoln had this off-the-shoulder satin white gown, and she had flowers, jasmine and violet, woven in her hair.
A sight to behold, certainly. But soon, the attention turned to the buffet table, which was empty until midnight.
So they had been dancing for a couple hours and were probably getting really hungry.
And then midnight struck. The decorum of the evening began to degrade rather quickly.
The buffet table was meant to only serve 300 people at a time, but everyone sort of rushed at once.
Food fight. I think we call that a food fight.
Exactly. It wasn't quite a food fight. As far as we know, people weren't tossing food around intentionally. Men would go over to the buffet table and they'd fill a tray of food to bring back to their dates and their friends. And they'd, you know, maybe hoist it above the rest of the crowd. And what happened was the food just slopped all over the floor and probably over people. There was actually a really, really interesting quote in the Washington Evening Star. The floor of the supper room was soon sticky, pasty, and oily with wasted confections, mashed cake, and debris of fowl and meat.
Well, here's to hoping President Obama's caterers can take a lesson from one of our forefathers. Megan Gambino wrote about Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural ball for Smithsonian.com, and you can see that menu at our website, npr.org. For 20 years, George Saunders has been writing short stories. Once a geological engineer who traveled the world, he started crafting wondrous short stories that combined the absurd and fantastic with the mundane realities of everyday life. One story about a professional caveman inspired those iconic Geico commercials. In 2006, he won the MacArthur Fellowship. This month, his new collection of stories came out. It's called 10th of December, and its reception has been nothing short of incredible. Reviewers have raved, and the New York Times Magazine called it, quote, the best book you'll read this year. George Saunders joins me now. George, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, what a reception to this book.
Yeah, it's been a pretty good week.
So let's talk about the craft of the short story, because as I mentioned, you've been working a long time at this. You teach at Syracuse University. Why the short story form?
Well, I kind of dumb answers. I just find it so beautiful, and I have not figured it out yet. I started maybe in my middle 20s trying to crack at it, and it's just a deep, deep well, you know. So when you get it right, it can be such a beautiful explosion of submerged meaning. So really, I kind of thought, well, I'll work on a few of these and then I'll write a novel. And it's just gone deeper and deeper over the years.
Because there aren't people who may not have read you, let's take a look at your work. And let's take a look at Victory Lap, which introduces us to two teenage characters. One of the things I love about your stories is these are very ordinary people, and we can relate to those people. They then get entangled in very extraordinary circumstances at times, but this is a girl who's imagining herself as a princess, meeting her suitor at a ball, as many young girls do. And her counterpoint here is a skinny boy, a neighbor, terrified of his very strict parents. Let's start by meeting Kyle. His really strict father has left him a work notice.
Sure. A scout, a new geode on deck. Place in yard per included drawing. No goofing. Rake areas first. Put down plastic, as I've shown you. Then lay in white rock. This geode expensive? Please take seriously. No reason this should not be done by time I get home. This is equal to 5 work points. Guard, Dad, do you honestly feel it fair that I should have to slave in the yard until dark after a rigorous cross-country practice that included 16 440s, 8 880s, a mile for time, a kajillion drake sprints, and a 5-mile Indian relay? Oh, shoes off, mister. Yoinks, too late. He was already at the TV and had left an incriminating trail of microclods. Waver boatin'. Could the microclods be hand-plucked? Although problem, if he went back to hand-pluck the microclods, he'd leave an incriminating new trail of microclods. He took off his shoes and stood mentally rehearsing a little show he liked to call What If Right Now? What if they came home right now?
So, George Saunders, this is so delicious because I'm just immediately in Kyle's head with him. And that's not a space that a reader always gets to inhabit with an author. And I was thinking, you've been a geophysicist, and I thought, you know, geode, it's perfect, because so many of your people are under these tectonic pressures of absolute rigidity, the rigidity of mortality, which we're all going to face, debt, which a lot of us face, futility, which I think most people feel at least once a day.
Right. For me, if I think about all those things, I kind of block up. But if I just concentrate on a human voice, I do this thing that I call a third-person ventriloquist, which is it's kind of a standard third-person voice at first, and then as quickly as I can, I try to get into the person's thoughts, but then with the extra kicker of trying to really use / restrict myself to his or her diction, when you're thinking in someone else's voice, you sort of do become them. So what I'm doing is kind of tapping into a part of me that is a 15-year-old boy, or in this case, a 15-year-old girl. So it gets really psychologically complex. What I found is this technique really makes me love these characters a lot, even when they're kind of messed up or they're doing things that are evil or questionable. Because you're entering the imaginative process through their doorway, it shifts the world a little bit on its axis.
Yeah. Another story in this book, you know, we mentioned a moment ago the way that you burnish your language by using the voice of people who find themselves in over their heads. I'm thinking of the Semplica Girl Diaries. Is that the one that took you 12 years to write?
That is. You know, I dreamed the basic image of the story, which is really disturbing. In the dream, I went to this window in our house and looked out in our yard, and there were these 4 or 5, I knew them to be sort of third world women, hanging on a kind of clothesline, and the clothesline actually went through their heads. And I understood these to be kind of lawn ornaments. They had on these beautiful white smocks. Welcome to my dream life. Mm-hmm. But the person I was who was seeing this disturbing image was actually kind of overjoyed and happy at the thing that he should have been disgusted by. I thought, oh my God, I am so lucky. I finally arrived. You know, and this feeling of gratitude that I've been able to do this wonderful thing for my family. So I kind of woke up from that dream, and it had some obvious, you know, kind of political, metaphorical implications. And so then the trick for the next 12 years was to kind of preserve the intensity of that first thing without having it just merely be a kind of propagandistic preaching job.
Let's go to a story that I think is really accessible, George. And that would be the title story of this collection, 10th of December. I quite loved it. And I thought, you know, there's almost a 50s feeling in here. This is about a boy who goes into the woods. He's kind of a misfit. He's going to encounter a very sick old man who's thinking about ending his life. And that, to me, is almost classic. Like, I could see Timmy and Lassie come home, but you've given it a complete, you know, contemporary twist. This is sort of near the end of the story where the little boy, Robin, has been saved, but his savior hasn't. Would you begin there?
Sure. With a shock, he remembered the old guy. What the heck? An image flashed of the old guy standing bereft and blue-skinned in his tighty-whities like a POW abandoned at the barbed wire due to no room on the truck. Or a sad, traumatized stork bidding farewell to its young. He'd bolted. He'd bolted on the old guy. Hadn't even given him a thought. Blimey. What a chicken thing to do. He had to go back, right now, help the old guy hobble out. But he was so tired. He wasn't sure he could do it. Well, probably the old guy was fine. Probably he had some sort of old guy plan. But he'd bolted. He couldn't live with that. His mind was telling him that the only way to undo the bolting was to go back now, save the day. His body was saying something else. It's too far. You're just a kid. Get Mom. Mom will know what to do. He stood paralyzed at the edge of the soccer field like a scarecrow in huge flowing clothes.
A sad, traumatized stork, bidding farewell to its young, a scarecrow in huge flowing clothes. I think one of the things that really hits me in your language is that it seems simple, but you have such a way with image.
Well, thanks. You know, honestly, so much of this stuff happens on the fly. And for me, one of the deepest pleasures is going into my little writing shed day after day and like, okay, today I have to write that scene where Robin makes a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just kind of waiting for one little detail to come in that will liven it up. Like that stork thing was something that it wouldn't have been a natural thing. I think it would have come after many drafts. You know, when you do interviews, you get a chance to talk about your work. You sort of want to jump to the safety place, which is the concept. Like, yes, well, I do. I often think about image, and image is something that, you know, but mm-hmm. in truth, the real artistic process, as I've understood it, is 95% intuitive, like seat of the pants, at the moment decisions that you can't even explain, you know.
Although again and again and again, which is why it can take 12 years
exactly.
to write a 24-page story.
Exactly. I always compare it to the, you know, the process of if somebody gave you a furnished apartment that they had furnished, your first impression would be, well, thanks, but also this doesn't feel like me. But then if you were allowed to replace one item a day for 7 years with an item that you liked better, after that 7 years, that place would have you all over it in ways that you couldn't have anticipated at the beginning. So likewise, in a story, if you're doing hundreds of drafts and each time you're micro-exerting your taste, that thing is going to start to look more and more and more like you. And in fact, I feel like my stories are much more indicative of me than this guy here talking to you or me on even my best day as a person. The story is a chance to sort of super compress whoever you are and present it in this slightly elevated way.
George Saunders is the author of the new collection, 10th of December. George, it really has been fun. Thank you.
It was a total pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to some new music from Sean Lennon. Yes, that Lennon, the son of John and Yoko. And as a composer, he's just as much his mother's son as his father's. As a matter of fact, he may lean more heavily toward the New York City avant-garde scene his mother helped to popularize. You can hear the results in two new albums he's just released. One you're listening to right now, it's an improvisational duo called Mystical Weapons. And the other album is the score to an independent film called Alter Egos. I asked John Lennon to briefly sum up this strange little film he worked on.
It's sort of a superhero comedy, and the director and writer is one of my best friends, this guy, Jordan Galland.
I love superheroes. Are you Fishman, Ben?
No, I'm Fridge. The F stands for Fridge. It's short for refrigerator.
Alter Egos is his sort of parody of superhero films. It's not a true superhero film. There's not a lot of action. It's more like a romantic comedy that just happens to use superhero costumes as a metaphor for being misunderstood, you know? So the girls fall in love with the persona of the sort of the front that these men put on, but inside they feel like, you know, they're not loved for who they really are.
And the grim, sad struggle to deliver, huh?
Indeed.
I'm your girlfriend, okay? And everybody knows that superheroes have these alter egos to hide among civilians. So you made up this Clark Kent-type loser, okay? I'm just trying to help you get free of this geek.
So this film score, you know, what really intrigued me about it was that it wasn't just one style of music, that it did demand the coherence, if you will, of going all over the map so that the film could have, you know, a propulsion and motion. And I'm just wondering if you and the director, Jordan Galland, collaborated about that before you sat down to write it.
Well, what actually happened was I had been working on a bunch of cues while he was shooting that were in this direction that we wound up scratching. And it was more of a kitsch direction. We were sort of modeling the music, or I was, after films like Barbarella and Danger Diabolic, the sort of kitsch Italian superhero world. Mm-hmm. And we thought that that would work because the movie was a sort of kitsch comedy about superheroes. But ultimately, when we laid in that music over the footage, it really didn't work because somehow it was just redundant. Because the scene was already kind of a joke, and then the music was sort of indicating that it was a joke. So it just felt less funny. So then we had to scratch actually about 15 cues that I'd done, and we were trying to edit for some kind of screening deadline, and so we only had 3 or 4 days to do the entire thing over again, so that was actually very daunting. But we realized at that point that we need the music to contrast with the film and be completely different, in that it should be dramatic and kind of grandiose and melodramatic, and that sort of made the characters seem funnier. The more serious the music got, the funnier the character's performance seemed.
And you can get that film, by the way, Alter Egos, on Netflix.
So, well, you can get the score at chimeramusic.com.
All right, good.
And you can order it from me directly.
All right.
I'll package it up myself and mail it off to
you. Ah, listen, you'll be having everybody doing that. I'm speaking with musician Sean Lennon. He's got two, not one, but two new albums. One is the score to the film we've been talking about, Alter Egos, and the other is an improvisational duo known as Mystical Weapons. So let's talk about Mystical Weapons. Now, this project is with Greg Saunier of the band Deerhoof, totally improvisational. So what was the mission statement, if you will, before you started on this piece of work?
Well, I'd always wanted to play with Greg. I was a huge fan of his band. After Deerhoof opened for Yoko Ono Plastic Ono Band show that I was music directing in Oakland. And, you know, we knew we were going to hang out then, so we wound up booking a small improv gig where we could open for some other band, just Greg and I jamming together.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be one of those sort of memorable moments where we just felt, wow, this was meant to happen. Let's do this again.
One that I particularly liked, Colony Collapse Disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels to me like the beginning of some really epic rock song, actually.
Well, it is an epic rock song, I think. That song, the fun thing about that is that the basic track, the concept for that song was how many instruments can I, you know, put within arm's reach to manage to play at the same time. So I was sitting in front of the Rhodes. My left foot, I had put a bass drum pedal on an actual bass guitar to hit the low string with my foot. And then I had a guitar in my lap, obviously. There was a synthesizer to my right, and I also had another guitar laying on a bench in an open tuning that I would just hit with this violin bow in the distance when I wanted to play these big open chords. They're like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, they were kind of running through a tremolo pedal you'll hear on this one.
You seem to be a really enthusiastic and meaningful collaborator with a lot of people. We've been speaking of, you know, different folks throughout this interview, and it seems to make you happy.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I've never really thought about it, but I do probably prefer collaborating to being alone in a sort of vacuum. I don't know why. It's an inherent part of my personality, but I think it's also maybe because I always knew that my dad was like that. I mean, I'd always heard about it, that, you know, he wanted to have writing partners. Like, and that was one of the reasons that he tried to get my mom to write with him. And she was more of an island, and is more of one of those kind of, you know, an artist as an island kind of people, where she likes to do everything by herself. And I know that my dad always felt sort of like maybe a little bit lonely in terms of the songwriting element. He was like, why don't you write with me more? And she's like, well, I don't do that.
In his early days, of course, he wrote with Paul McCartney.
Exactly. So I always grew up thinking, like, you know, maybe that's how you're supposed to do it, because I always knew that he wrote a lot of those songs, you know, with Paul. And so I was always looking for people to collaborate with.
Sean Lennon. He just released two new albums, one with his avant-garde duo, Mystical Weapons, and the other his score to the film, Alter Egos. To hear a few samples, please go to our website, nprmusic.org. Well, Sean, it's just been a real pleasure.
It's been awesome to be here. I'm a huge fan of the show.
For the week ending January 20th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Acacia Squires, Becky Hersher, Chris Connolly, and Becky Sullivan. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rood. Sheila Newman edited the show. Our technical directors are Rob Berman and Daniel Shukin. And Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for tuning in.